Hello, welcome back, everybody. We have three people on the pod. Is
Everyone
it?
else is stuck at Burning Man.
Oh, yeah, brutal. Yeah, I don't know if we should talk about that at all. It's been all over my social media, and I'm just like kind of just sick of it. You have like the camp of like, it's not that bad, we're making it through, and the other camp is just like hating on them. And other people are just like, I want to get the fuck out of here. It's just kind of been a lot of news. I don't know if that's just on my TikTok and Twitter, but it's been a lot.
I wouldn't be a happy camper. I'm not gonna lie to you. If I went to the desert and got stuck in the mud, you would see me just ranting. But alas, I wouldn't even have internet, so I don't know. To anyone out there, we hear you.
Well,
I know
no.
you're not gonna hear
Starlink.
us.
Starlink.
I hear you. It's just like only I think it's half the camps have Starlink, so
That's still 45,000 people or whatever, or what is it? No, 35,000 people.
well. If you're one of the people stuck in the Exodus and you can hear us right now, our hearts go out to you. And if you're one of the people who can't hear you, well, you probably don't have internet, so you're not listening to podcasts.
Do your hearts go out to the CEOs who have employees who are missing additional work because they were stuck at
Or
Burning
the
Man?
or yes.
That's me
Yes.
right now.
How
So,
many people on
Sarah.
your team are stuck?
So there's three people at Winnie that are there. One got out like early when you weren't
Yeah.
supposed to. He managed to escape, and he provided an account of his stay, and it just sounded horrible. Like it was just the most miserable thing, and people trying to help each other get unstuck. He was trying to drive his car through the mud. And then another woman, it sounds like was in a really good camp where everyone was kind of had a lot of supplies and materials, and she was like, it was a great time, it was wonderful, and she got out, but she then got stuck in really bad traffic, so
Oh,
is
I can
stuck
only
in
imagine.
Truckee right now. And then
Oh my God.
third guy that I haven't heard from yet, so hopefully he's okay.
That guy's just living the dream, the guy who you
Yes.
haven't heard from.
Right.
Yeah, I hope you like I saw that someone died and I was like, oh my God, like I
Yeah.
really hope
I think
not him.
that's I don't think that's anything new for festivals that large. But anyways, it was but this brings up a topic, and I know we were talking about this, like so Burning Man has kind of turned into well, it was initially for hippies and all that, and it's kind of turned into a lot of like super rich people, and also there's a lot of like the founder community that actually go. So I know a lot of founders that go. I've never actually personally been, but kind of brought up a bigger point to like we get invited to a lot of these events. So like for one, have you guys been to like the what's so what is what are some of the events that go on? Burning Man, there's like the lobby conference that's in Hawaii. There's like what's the there's the other really big events company that's slipping in my mind.
Summit at Sea.
Summit at Sea, I went to that one once. Yeah. Have you guys been? What do you guys think? Is it worth people's time to go to network, or is it just a waste of time?
I will not go on a conference on a boat where I cannot leave.
Okay. So that's just they also have summit that they do that at mountains and stuff like that too. Have you been to anything?
Can I come off the mountain?
Yes, of course. You would drive up there if you want. Yeah. But my point is more broadly, like, is it a good place to network with other founders? Like, and my thought also would be like, do high quality founders go to those things versus work on their startups, or if they have if they have families, like those types of things. Like, I don't know. What are your guys' opinions on that?
I think you have to pick and choose. Like you have to find your community. So I
Yeah.
attend the lobby conference, which is an amazing event, and
Every year you do?
I missed it last year, but I have attended.
I've been there once. I miss you there then.
I
Okay.
saw you once there a very long
Oh,
time ago.
okay. Yeah.
And one of the reasons I love the lobby conference is, well, first of all, it's a confidential community, so everything you talk about there
Right.
stays within the group, and you can go pretty deep. I've made some good connections there. It's also a family friendly event, so I haven't brought my family all that much, but I have brought them and I'm bringing them again this year.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kids aren't going to the sessions where you're talking to other founders, but they can go to some of the nighttime events. And it's just great to have that option so that I'm not just like escaping every year and excluding, you know, all the rest of the people in my life. But, you know, I can only pick so many conferences to go to. So I kind of pick and choose the ones that I find really valuable.
Right.
They're because I've built, you know, valuable for the business. So another one I go to is ASU GSV.
Yep.
Like an ed tech conference. And that's really pretty valuable for Winnie for me to attend that. But otherwise, I'm pretty choosy and I'll only attend if I'm speaking and I think it's a good opportunity for the company.
Andy. Yeah.
I've gone to Lobby once. I really enjoyed it. As Sarah says, I found it to be in a really well done, well programmed, off the record conference with great sessions. And so I would definitely go to that again. That's pretty much the only social driven conference I've been to. I went to the Upfront Summit once. Mark Suster is on the board of my previous company, Nanit. So that was his conference. And then I used to go to CES every year. That was purely work related. At Nanit, some of our buyers were there, but all of our suppliers were there. And it's one of the few conferences where everyone comes. And when you make electronics, a lot of your suppliers are in Asia. And it's very rare to get everyone in the same room and not have to do a world tour. So we would go to that every year. Besides that, I have not gone to any other tech conferences and I go to almost nothing.
I think for me, I definitely, I moved from Canada to San Francisco about a decade ago, early in my career, especially before family, I'd go to like basically anything, like events, like just trying to like I remember before SF was like a wasteland, there used to be like a, well, I guess it's not a wasteland anymore if you're in AI, but like, I remember like Dropbox held a lot, like lots of events and like Yelp and like, they'd always have like speakers and stuff like that. And then you also had these bigger conferences and I did Summit at Sea once. I made some good contacts. Lobby conference, I'd say I made some good contacts, but also I think as like the way that I look at it now, like as your network grows or grows, I think the opportunity cost probably is larger, but I think there's like a step function. Like if you could get invited to like imagine your, SBF and you get invited to Burning Man and you're in like Elon's camp, like you go to Burning Man. Like, I think that like there's, I think that really, of course, I mean, we get invited to like that level of things. So I think that we're not quite at that level yet. I think there's another level of like people just getting together that we
running
don't get invited.
Scam business, like you're talking about. You have to go to all these things because all you're doing is scamming people. So
okay, don't use him as an example, but use like you're a hot company and you're like getting invited and you're like rubbing elbows with like Larry Page and like all of these like people. Like that's what they kind of do. Like they're not building a lot, but like they could be a great investment. I was on the verge of that before it shipped, but wasn't quite at that level. So I definitely see it's like, early days in your career, I would recommend going to as many things as you can to build your network. Then as it kind of, you built it out, like focus more on building and recruiting and all those things. And then if you are getting your company to another level, I think there's other conferences and other things that we don't even know about that then you should go and be a part of. So hopefully as all of us get better, we'll have these unspeakable conferences that we could talk about maybe internally about.
I think it's also, you know, you can't just show up and then hope for all the magic to happen. It's about relationship building. So you have to, you know, think about who you want to meet at this conference, what your goals are. Is it to raise money? Like 1 year, I attended the lobby conference and I was actually closing a fundraising round. So I kind of made it a goal to talk to some people who could fill out that round and it worked. But other years it's more about me and building a founder community and folks that I might be able to go to for advice and support. But then you got to, you know, pay attention to those people, keep the relationships up. It's not just transactional. It's about, you know, actually just getting to know them. So, you know, maybe down the road, you might have something you want to ask them about. And, you know, the same thing for when I attend work related conferences that are for my industry. I want to have like a set of meetings in advance and not just show up and kind of expect that people will find me.
Did that lobby conference, did it actually help you close that round?
Yes.
Great.
So there was like an investor that I was kind of talking to, and then I met in person at the conference.
Oh, that's so huge. Yeah.
Timing and, you know, I think he would have invested anyway, but, you know, now we have
an
even better relationship because we've met in real life.
Right.
So, you know, it's just another, you know, it's not the only chance to meet investors and other founders, but when you get a bunch of people in one place, it's kind of a good way to check a number of people off your list in an efficient way. And same thing for industry conferences, like everyone is showing up. You can just get all the conversations done. You can meet with, you know, I always hate meeting with VCs and private equity firms that are, you know, when I'm not fundraising, because it's a waste of time. But my one exception is if I'm at a conference already and it's like a quick 15 minute meeting and I can kind of get a pulse check on what they're looking for in the industry and just, you know, make sure they know Winnie is still out there. That is the one time I will have those kinds of meetings.
Sarah, I heard any VC or PE investor can book you on intro. Is that true?
Oh, yes. Also, if you want to pay, especially if you're just picking my brain about the childcare industry and you're not intending to invest, but you want to learn about the industry, that is a great way to learn about the industry without anyone feeling like their time got wasted.
Do you have a lot of people that actually take you up on that?
Not investors, no.
Oh, but no, I mean just generally.
Yeah, so the people that have booked me, I've had two bookings, have been founders looking to start businesses in the kind of parenting space.
Cool.
And I feel like it was worth their time because hopefully I got some stuff that took me a long time to figure out. Like I could just tell them and tell them what not to do, which is sometimes a painful thing to say, but I feel like if they're paying, I should be honest. No VC has booked me on intro, though they should.
I am waiting for a VC to book me on intro. It has yet to happen. I have also taken two bookings. I would love to see someone book us after this podcast.
Yes.
So if you're out there and listening, please book Sarah or I.
Yeah. Andy, I think you shared this. Somebody actually had like an autoresponder on LinkedIn that it is like, who was this?
It
was
not an autoresponder, but it's me. If you call,
no, but there is someone who also set up an autoresponder.
Maybe it was from you, Sarah. Yeah.
No, it was some kind of product person influencer type. I forget. Someone who it was the guy who keeps selling his companies to.
Oh yeah.
Who
that's right.
He keeps building these social apps that he's like turning around and selling for
Nikita, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So he, you know, I'm sure gets a lot of these like, check out my app, give me feedback, and set up this autoresponder.
That's really funny.
I get so many of those a week. I don't know about you all. Check out my app, give me feedback, or just like generic scams or spam. And it's like, I just respond with that link. If anyone wants to book me, have fun.
My LinkedIn is a complete mess. I've kind of abandoned it. Luckily for us, somebody that's on this podcast, Joe, is building potentially the next LinkedIn. So look out for that soon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It looks, I've seen some demos of it. It looks really cool. What other topics do you guys have today? What's on your mind?
I saw a very interesting tweet, and I'll throw it out there. I think it's just venture in general. It was a tweet from the IVP folks, and basically they said the number of meetings they were seeing in their CRM software was 4x, like mid to end of August. And I think what's going on in the venture industry right now is everyone who started to delay who delayed fundraising for most of 23 or got a little bit of a top-up round now has to go out. And
yes.
I think the venture industry got some vacation at the end of August, but I think it's back to a lot of companies are going out right now. And I'm curious what you're hearing from your friends. I mean, I think, Kevin, you've been doing a raise and it's been successful, and we're all really proud of you. Sarah, I don't know what your fundraising status is, but I know we all talk to our friends, and I'm sure you have a bunch of founder friends who are in this predicament or situation.
I think right now, I think that definitely even before VCs got back from Burning Man, there was a heightened level of, I wouldn't say FOMO, but I think more interest in actually like closing and writing some checks, just from the people that I talked to, and also just myself as well, which has not been the case for like the last two quarters. The last two quarters have been fucking brutal. So I think that things are, I think that the markets are calming down, and also like the bank failures and interest rates. Yeah, we now know that we're probably going to be at like higher interest rates for the kind of the foreseeable future, and people are getting used to that and everything. And people like can now see that like SaaS multiples are still, they're climbing, and like we have the FANGs that are performing really well. So I think that is all a good backdrop, to have a pretty good fall. And hearing now we have like two companies, three companies going out for IPOs. We have Instacart, we have Klaviyo, who is a SMS and email company for Shopify customers, which is very, 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 this is the first like Shopify like built on company going public. So very adjacent to what we're building. So I'm paying a lot of attention to that. And then there's the Arm, which is the SoftBank company that's also going public too. So I think that after that, we'll see what happens in the public markets, which kind of then trickles down to the private markets. But yeah, I think that I hope that fall now, seeing that if you're seeing that IVP is getting four times a meeting requests, like that's going to mean that it's still going to be hard to get a deal done because there's so many more people that are actually going to be going out to fundraise. So I don't know if that makes it easier, but I hope that means that more A and B's and C rounds are going to get done.
Yeah, I don't know what it means. I think it's the analogy of more applications to Harvard. There's only a certain number of slots. No matter if the total volume of applications goes up, there's only still 1,000 seats in the class or something like that. I'm making up these numbers. I think it's an interesting dynamic, though. I think for most of 2023, if you didn't have to raise, you kept your head down. And now all of a sudden, you're going to have to take a dose of reality, or maybe you grew into your business.
Or you got profitable like Sarah.
Yeah, I don't think founders should be fooled by this activity and go out and raise if they weren't planning to. I still think it's going to be incredibly brutal. I think there's, you know, August, you couldn't even get a meeting probably because everyone was away. Now you can get a meeting and tons of companies need to fundraise. And I'm sure deals are going to get done, but they're going to be really crappy deals. So I wouldn't, unless you really need to, or, you know, you are already planning to and you have really strong metrics. I think, you know, don't be fooled just because meetings are happening that it's actually a good time to raise.
What's your advice for that person out there who doesn't have the capital and knows they're going to have to take a crappy deal? That's to you, Sarah.
Yeah. I mean, I think first and foremost, you can always shut down your company. That's not the end of the world. I don't want to make it sound like you're a failure if you shut down your company. Of course, that's always an option. You can try again and become a second time founder and come on this podcast. So don't feel bad if that's the state you're in and you've evaluated your business and you don't want to go on. That's a totally fair option to pursue. But if you do want to go on and you feel like you just need more time and more capital, you got to take the deals that are out there. And so that may just be really resetting expectations, really getting diluted, maybe an entire recap of your, you know, cap table. But your job as a CEO is to make sure your company lives to see another day. If you believe it should, if you believe it should be shut down, go ahead and do that. But if you believe it should exist and you want to keep seeing it through, your job is to make sure you see another day, no matter how you get that done. And that may be at a huge cost right now, but
I mean,
you can still get it done if you believe and you want to make it happen. It may mean taking double the number of meetings you would have normally taken to get a deal done. But
yeah, and I think this is why it's one of the many reasons it's so hard to be like a founder or a CEO of a startup, because there's we're still in a down market, and even though that some deals are getting done and maybe some companies going public and the public markets are ripping, I still know, and we all know here, there's people that in our networks that are still laying off people. We have not seen the total bottom of it. And that's really, really hard to do, obviously, but it's your chance to live another day, which is that is, I think, always the job of the CEO is make sure you have enough money in the bank. Make sure that you actually set the vision for the company and make sure you hire the best people. Those are really, in my opinion, the three things that CEO founders really should be doing. I'd love to get Andy's take on it, because what I've seen from Andy is he's probably one of the most scrappiest people as far as, so Andy's background is as an investor. And I don't know if you want to go into just talk generally, what can people do to reduce burn or push off paying bills? I learned a lot from you, and I think anybody listening from here that's maybe trying to trim costs and everything can learn. I don't know. I've just been impressed by what you've been able to do, Andy, if you're able to talk to any of it.
Yeah. I think the reality is you can always, I think we all, I've started a couple companies. I come from a VC background, and I was in finance before that. And I think we always think we need all these people to accomplish so much. And I think most engineers will tell you you're going to get a lot more done with four people than you're going to get a lot done with 12. But when everyone is throwing $20 million at you or $10 million at you over the last couple of years, what do you do with the money? Well, I think the first and foremost hire was every CEO hired a chief of staff. Then there was an ops team. There were probably two or three people on the ops team. Then you started padding engineering. Instead of having five people searching for PMF, you had 12, so on and so forth. And I think as a wartime CEO and in a different interest rate environment, you have to really think about, what do I need in this company? I think a lot of people here forget that Microsoft went public when they were profitable in 1980 something or late 70s. And I, to that same regard, I think you can really do a lot with much less than you expect. One day when this is all over, I'll tell everyone about Nanit and how small the team is comparatively to the size of the business. And I just think there's been a lot of bloated cost structure. We've all seen companies with $1 million of revenue and 100 employees. What are they all doing? I have no idea. There was something online recently, and it was number of employees per $1 billion of revenue. And the most they're all energy companies when you start looking at it. And there's some of these energy companies that have 90 employees for $1 billion in revenue. And then think about some of our friends' software companies who at its peak in 2021 had 140 employees for $500,000 in revenue. What were they doing is, I guess, the big question I'd love to know.
That's true. Can you talk a little bit about vendor management and even as far as different terms that you've negotiated. I've been really impressed by that. Like, I don't think that people realize that they can actually negotiate those types of things. Or if you're in a really tough position, like not paying certain bills and like stuff like that.
Yeah. So I think things that you worry about, that you think about a lot in more private equity backed businesses, or you work in capital. And
yes.
Very rarely do you think about this a lot in early stage venture backed business. And it's timing of when you're paid versus timing of when you're going to pay people. So if you have a software company, if you can convince everyone up front by giving them a discount to pay for 1 year of service up front, well, all of a sudden you get the ability to use that cash.
Right.
So I think
right.
that is just use of cash that you're getting from your customers. At the same time, you have to pay out your suppliers. If you can then simultaneously ask your suppliers for payment days, net 15, net 30, as you start getting into more in hardware.
Net 90.
90, that golden rule. Well, you could basically get paid from a customer 30 days in advance and then not have to pay a supplier for 120 days. And you have all this cash flow to float your business. Now, as you start going towards profitable private equity backed businesses, this use of working capital is a significant source of capital for your free cash flow.
Yeah.
Traditional venture backed businesses, we don't think about this, but if you ask anyone who's bootstrapped anything, they'll tell you about this every day of the week. And so
right.
I think that's a great place to leave this topic. I think you can learn a lot about this online, but I think your goal as a founder should always to be on your vendors, get as much terms as possible, and as you're from your customers, get paid as fast as possible. And I mean, that happens to every software company where they're invoicing. And they'll invoice. I mean, we all have some of these software providers for our business where we have a contract and they're going to invoice us and we're going to pay them 30 days later.
Right.
They're giving us financing.
So I'll talk through my learnings here. And I think that, so if you are just a traditional SaaS company, you probably like don't have a lot of like wiggle room. Like you essentially have like your hard costs that are going to be your servers and you're charging for your software and you probably don't have a lot of payment terms, but like marketplaces or like hardware businesses are different. So giving an example, so me being an engineer before I started companies, like I was just like software focused and didn't like running also my last company Ship, like there was a lot of hard costs and I never got my MBA or something like that. I didn't actually know what a P&L was. And I think that if I would have actually understood like cash flows more, I think that it would have allowed me to make better decisions. So give you an example of a company that I think is doing like this at like massive scale. So Rita Lane, who essentially did all the manufacturing for Apple. So she was the one who took everything. She reported to Tim Cook before he was the CEO. She took all the manufacturing to China, and she was able to negotiate with their suppliers that they would actually never. And so even to this day, they airship all of their products from China. And they actually don't pay their actual supplier until the end customer receives the goods. So they literally, they don't have any payment terms at all because they're so good at their projections to their suppliers. They have so much purchasing power. So like, obviously you as a startup are not going to be able to do a lot of those different things, but like those things really do matter. So like for us as a marketplace, we do our best to collect and automatically invoice people we have just done recently in this last year, a massive invoicing project that is going to enable us to scale much faster off of gross revenue than net revenue for a marketplace perspective. Same thing with Airbnb comes to mind as well, like for their cash flow, right? Like if you book a stay, they collect the money up front, like, and then they don't actually pay the host until it's actually, you stay there. And so that flow can potentially be working capital that you could use. And so I think that outside of like traditional SaaS, there's a lot of things, and I'd love to hear, Sarah, if you have any of those things in your business that are kind of marketplace-ish that you've thought about on cash flow. But like for me, I was just so blind that like I probably could have done a lot more with Ship, or probably listened to a lot more of the finance people in, that were probably being like, you should do this. I'm like, no, I'll just focus on product. That's all that matters. And maybe that's why the Ship was as good of a product. But I don't know. Sarah, what's your take on if you've looked at any of the cash flow stuff?
I have. I mean, I think it's at a certain stage, it's you don't want to over-optimize for it.
Totally.
And so, you know, it is important for us like to get as many customers on automatic billing as possible. So we don't want to be like invoicing them and then waiting for them to pay an invoice 30 days later. We want to make sure we can charge them.
Which is huge. That right there is my exact example. Like the auto invoicing versus giving them net 30 or net 60 day terms. It seems like a simple decision up front, but it makes such a huge difference when you think about the profitability of your business and like running it efficiently and all those things.
Right. So we want things to basically work out, but it's not that important to us if we're paying a vendor, you know, immediately or after or at 30 days. Like it doesn't help us out that much at this stage. I think what has been more important for us with managing expenses is just taking an approach of like, instead of trying to go down our expenses and figure out what to cut, we've done the exercise kind of the reverse. Like, what do we absolutely need to run the business? And then what things are nice to have? Especially as contracts come up for renewal, we kind of know like, okay, this one we can try to renegotiate, but we actually can't run the business without Stripe right now. And it's not going to be worth investing in some other competitor. So we're, you know, going to be okay with whatever Stripe offers versus like, you know, some of these cool analytics tools, like we like them and they're nice, but we don't need them. Like if we don't have this monitoring tool, we'll be okay. We'll survive without it, or we
like Mode. We talked about Mode on this podcast before, and may not be a fan.
It's not that I'm not a fan. I think there's just
sorry to cut you off, Sarah.
I think Sarah, we cut you totally off, but I think the analytics tools is like the biggest bull market. Yeah. It's like, do I want we have console logs from LogRocket, we have it from Datadog, we have product level analytics. It's like spending $250,000 a year on analytics.
Yeah, we're spending a lot on analytics. That has been, you know, kind of that ordering of things has been useful, because then I have just made the decision to cut some things that like the team has said, well, it's really nice. And I'm like, is it absolutely required or is it nice? And then, you know, just cut it. And it turns out no one was using it. We could live without it. I think that's it's really hard to get people to part ways with something. So going down the list, they're like, oh no, I use that. I want that. But if I'm like, what is absolutely required? This site would not work without it. And then let's build up from there based on the budget we want to allocate towards these things. It turns out very little, and you can do the same with people. And that not an amazing, it doesn't feel great. And certainly like if you're in a position where you don't have to lay people off, don't lay people off if you are making great use of everyone. But that is, you know, when we had that SVB banking crisis and we weren't going to make payroll, we actually had to look at furloughing the entire team, because if you can't pay people, you can't keep them employed. That's illegal. If you know you don't have the funds to pay them. So we looked at like, well, who is absolutely needed to run the service? And kind of got that smaller list. And that was kind of enlightening with regards to like, how many employees do you actually need?
Right.
I think we've all learned, we all sit there and think, okay, do I need software or do I need a spreadsheet? And I think a year or two ago, everyone would have paid for the software because somebody on their team was advocating it for it. But now it's like, I saw the, I think we probably all saw it, the renewal for your ATS system coming up. And for anyone who doesn't know what ATS is, that's like the levers or the,
I forget. We got rid of ours. We have nothing.
I can't imagine.
What do you guys use now? What do you use?
I mean, first of all, we're not really hiring. So we don't need, we can manually track applicants for the few positions we are recruiting for. We can just put the hiring manager in charge with a spreadsheet of keeping track of everything. And we list the jobs. What is the new Wellfound? It's called, it's a new AngelList rebrand. It's free to post your jobs there.
Oh, I didn't realize they rebranded that. Yeah, I was just going to suggest AngelList because that's what we used in the past as well.
You can post jobs for free. They obviously try to upsell you on a paid product, but if you're not actively really trying to fill a bunch of positions, their free product is more than sufficient.
Right.
I couldn't agree with you more here. You were hiring 20 people, this stuff mattered, but one hiring manager hiring one individual can track the 30 applicants that come through wherever they're coming through in a Google Sheet or Airtable or whatever fancy software you'd like to use that has spreadsheet-like functionality.
And that was an example of something that I was like, can we get rid of Lever? And everyone was like, no, we like it. We have to recruit. And I was like, do we absolutely need it? Would you be able to recruit for a position without it? And then the answer was, no, we don't.
I feel sorry for the folks running those type of companies this year. It's got to be brutal.
I was just gonna pose that as maybe like our next topic, like these types of businesses that were like really great in the boom times that are just seen, like we're all talking about them, right? The ones like the ATS systems, all the nice to haves and all that. They were the ones that were growing at 200-300% year over year and maybe getting to hundreds of millions of dollars in ARR. And now they're growing at like 20-50%, or maybe there's a free version that people are willing to use. I think of Calendly is another example. I think there's like a version that's like, which I actually love Calendly and I still use it, but like, everybody right now, and this is also how like you get profitable, and like we've all been through this kind of looking through all of our spends, but like it's like, can we trim costs on like, can we go to a cheaper Calendly? Like it's really software. I'm not sure how much they charge per seat, but I think it's got to be like at least like $12 a month or something like that. And so like, those must be super hard businesses to run because like they're just kind of like, and this kind of goes back to, and maybe this is my initial point, that like I always, even through our journey at Airhouse, I initially thought that we had like a 10x better solution. It turns out to be for certain customers, we definitely don't. I now know which version that we do have. But I think that for you to truly survive the up and down times of just the technology and the markets and everything, you have to have a 10x better solution. Like, is Lever a 10x better solution to AngelList? No, clearly it's not. Like a free product, pretty sure it's free, right? It's free, right? And you could probably name so many other applications like that are not 10x better than the other competitors, and probably because they don't have a big moat. And so like, I think that as you're building your company, like I've always thought about how can you have a 10x better solution? How can you have a moat? I don't know. What do you guys think about that as you think about building your companies?
I think it's a huge miss that Lever doesn't have a free version. So at Winnie, we experienced exactly this. We, you know, are really used by childcare centers who need to recruit families to fill their open spaces. And there was a period of time when childcare centers didn't need any families because they didn't have enough teachers. So they literally paid to fill open spaces. They didn't have open spaces.
Right.
They was in classrooms. And we have a free version. So we didn't churn any of our large customers. They could go down to a really minimal spend, or even some of them paused entirely. But they kept using the product through the free version, and we kept the relationship up. We built other stuff for them that they could pay us for, that they needed for their business.
Right.
And then when they were ready and, you know, things came back and they could take families and needed to fill spaces, it was just really easy to ramp back up and we didn't miss a beat. And I feel like that was a miss with Lever. Like, why not just have a free version?
Yeah.
Then they could have, you know, at least retained the relationship with all these companies who then are hiring for a trickle of positions here or there, or maybe they could offer them, you know, some other adjacent thing that they needed, like offboarding services for layoffs.
Right.
And make some money that way. I feel like having a free version of the product is key in times like these, especially if you're a business that has some like of this seasonality or cyclical nature to it.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the one thing that I think every founder is looking at, and if you haven't looked at and you're listening out there, is like cashback credit cards. So whether it's Ramp, Rex, Divvy, et cetera.
SVB.
SVB has one too. I didn't know that. Okay. So there are 100 of these, but they're all like, how do you say you actually get cash back at the end of the year? And for a lot of us, our inventory isn't paid on credit card. It's just travel and software. But I was with somebody this weekend who they get to pay for all their inventory on credit card. And they were out there negotiating two of the big credit card, the Ramps and the Brex off each other to see if they could get like an extra point back, which would end up saving them like $500,000 a year. I just think like these are the type of things that people should like very low.
That's
effort.
What we do, actually.
Yeah. So very low effort, very high ROI type of Pareto analysis decisions that can really drive some incremental cash for your business versus like, okay, do we need to save $16 on a piece of software?
Yeah.
Right.
Right. But going back to what Sarah said, I think this is something we should kind of drill into. So I've definitely noticed from our business, like we actually don't provide as much value to like the smaller brands. Like we're a network of 3PLs, global 3PLs. And early on, we would do anything we could do to get any like brand to start using us. But now we've discovered that the larger the brand, the actual more value they actually get from us. So I think that when you're going through this time, you're able to like really like you have to examine all of the pieces of your business. And this is what Sarah, what I'm assuming you've done. It's like, where do we provide the most value? Do you guys think like, and I truly do believe this, the only winners in all these products is that you have to be 10x better than your like competitors. And so like where Slack's a great example, they're a free tier until you reach a critical mass, right? They're probably not like the best use of like, cause you probably have a messaging group and name your messaging group or whatever, but like when you get over a certain amount of people or you need a certain amount of features, it actually makes sense to pay. And they are that 10x better solution. I don't know what you guys like feel about that, but it feels like from an existing company that has grown up in the 0% interest rate phenomenon where every like internet company would just like lever. It's like, I don't give a shit. Like we're hiring a shitload of people and like, doesn't really matter. You're right. Like they should have had it at free tier, but like, as we're saying that if like a hiring manager has like 20 or 30 different positions they're hiring for, Lever makes a ton of sense and you're going to pay for it. So for one, does that make it harder for the people that have grown up in this industry? And then does that give like an advantage of people like Sarah that you're mentioning now, like that you're offering, like you realize you don't like probably provide enough value or people can't pay on if they don't have enough daycares on your service and stuff like that. I don't know exactly what I'm trying to say, but like, I'll say what I'm thinking myself is like, I realize now where we provide a 10x better solution and where we can like just blow everybody else out. And I think that's really hard to recognize. And also, especially if you have been like the darling, like if you've been the Notions or the whoever of what, and you've just been killing it, I think it's really hard to change that.
Well, this actually might be lever strategy. Like they may have a target customer. It's not Winnie. And so they're willing to let us go. They don't need to provide a free product to Winnie.
I think that's silly, though. I think that's silly.
They may have found their niche. For example, we now help daycares hire staff. And a lot of the daycares that we're talking to are using Lever as their ATS. So they may have found a niche with, you know, maybe businesses that are hiring not tech workers, but a different kind of worker. And that may be their focus. And they know they provide a 10x better solution for them. And they're just going to double down on that, which I think is a good strategy in this environment. Focus on where you're delivering a ton of value, those customers, and go deep with them rather than trying to go broad right now when it's hard to make a land grab in this kind of environment.
I think you make an excellent point, and I think we actually kind of missed that. So we're talking about Lever. We're not picking on them for the folks who work there. It just happened to be an example.
Yeah.
But we're thinking about the world from the tech industry. The tech industry has consistently gone through layoffs. But if you look at some of the service sector or the rest of the U.S., we're going through actually some incredibly low unemployment rates. And most large employers are still having trouble filling the open roles they have. Right. And so we're sitting here thinking about this as the problem is, oh, they don't have a free version for tech companies, but the reality maybe they want to focus on the Walmarts of the world
or the daycares that aren't hiring a ton of staff right now. And so that I think that's exactly probably it. Like, we're not giving Lever enough credit. They probably have a strategy here that doesn't involve tech companies who are shedding employees like crazy. I think, yeah, like you said, they're focused on other industries right now, as they should be, and that's smart.
Well, I'll kind of take the other side of the argument, maybe, that like this is where like the next generation of, like, if you're going to create Lever, that you're going to realize that people aren't hiring right now, or they're going to be hiring for very few positions. So of course you'd have a freemium tier, and then you want to get people up to the next tier. And so, and to make that when they are hiring that many people, it's like, at what point do they become the 10x better solution? It's like, for them, it's like, how many people are they hiring per hiring manager or something like that? Like, that makes sense to me. And I think that it is really hard for you to go back on your initial decisions. Like Lever, they have like an entire go-to-market team that is all like based on like that they compensate like their SDRs, their AEs, like everything like that. It's all built on that. To go and like to take that down and like rebuild it all to like a freemium model is just really fucking hard. Right. And so like I think that's also a benefit for companies that are being built today to think like that, the companies that were getting built in like the high flying, and obviously Lever is a great business, but I'm sure their growth is like down a lot. I'm sure it is, because people are just not renewing. So I think that's when you see VCs on Twitter to be like, the best companies get built in like the downturns and everything. I think that is totally true, because you get your foundation right and you're forced to figure out like what your 10x better solution is. And like, you just don't survive without that. But when times are riding high and cash is free and all of these things, you're able to just build on top of the existing ecosystem. So like, I think that, I don't know. Andy, I'd love to get your,
I'll take the opposite side of this.
Okay, cool.
So we're talking about free, and I don't know anything about this business, Lever, besides the fact that
I don't know why we picked Lever. Lever is, I like it as a product. It's great.
Yeah, I really do like much. It as, I'm going to set the record straight and say nothing we said was against the folks at Lever, and we really like the product.
We got to get the Lever CEO on here.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
It just happened to be the case study we picked. And so, look, I think from a business to go from a sales-driven model to then going to a free model is a very large decision from a go-to-market perspective. And I think we're all talking about it. And I believe that's a company that's only sales-driven. I don't know enough about them. freemium in itself is very expensive to run as a go-to-market strategy. Each free user is a marketing acquired user in some ways, if you could think about it like that. I think there are great case studies of companies at scale that have been able to do this and switch from sales-driven models to self-service models.
No, that's very, I don't, can you name one?
HubSpot.
Okay, it's very hard to go like from like enterprise down to like product-led growth.
It's the not opposite enterprise is not from true. Product-led growth. It's more sales-driven to self-service. And there are more examples than you realize that have done this, and they've been able to implement a self-service strategy.
Okay.
But it takes a different go-to-market muscle. And so it's very tough to do what we're describing for the folks at who have a sales-driven product to then go launch a free version because you're going to cannibalize yourself.
You have to build a different sales ops team,
a marketing team, et cetera. Yep. So we're talking about this in a little bit of a vacuum. But at the end of the day, it is what it is. And your job is to find your ICP and to know your ICP and to sell your product to that ICP. And so I don't know what's going on at that company. And I'm sorry we picked on them for everyone out there.
All right. We got a few more minutes. What do we got? 9 minutes left. Anybody have any additional topics? I'm sure I could figure another one out.
Kevin's going to pick on another company next and destroy them.
Yeah, of course. And then we'll try to get them on the pod.
Yeah, the only way.
I think that what we all have experienced, the three of us here, going through a downturn is going to make us all healthier and also the industry more healthy. I think that we got super bloated. Like the 0% interest rate of free cash and crypto and all this fucking crazy shit, which didn't provide any like real value to users. It's at least gone for the moment. And it's really like when you start running out of cash, you don't have any other choices, like me included. And I'm assuming Sarah is also in this bucket as well. Like, You just go through this reflection of like focusing on what is the most important. And you also have to make a lot of like hard, like personnel choices, which the providers definitely are not as hard of choices. A lot of companies don't make it out of this. But I think that coming out of this, I'm extremely bullish, way more than I ever have been on software. And I think that coming out of like this vintage, so say what year are we even in? We're in 2023. So I think the vintage of companies that have survived this year, I don't want to like be super dramatic to like compare it to like the 2000s as far as like Amazon's the only one to come out of this and like look at how good they are doing. But I think that everybody's been focused, and especially the companies that have made it through here, but also the companies that are starting that actually can provide a 10x better product and really scale that are going to have so much better fundamentals. And I'm personally just glad to have gone through this, and we're still surviving and thriving. So hopefully we'll continue to do that. I'd love to get a check on both of you. Like, what do you think is this downturn, this banks are running out of money and getting like, we don't have access to our cash and all these things. Like, do you think that this is going to make the industry better or worse? Do you think that in another 10 years, we're going to end up in the same place that we were before, where we're just like building shit on top of shit on top of shit? What do you guys think?
I see a bubble that happens every 10 to 15 years. It happens in biotech. It happens in tech. It happens in venture. It's happened since the 80s. It'll continue to happen. People forget. People leave the industry. People have a very short-term mindset. Think about the housing bubble in 2007. It can go on and on and on. So yeah, people forget about this.
So what is your advice to somebody who is going to be a serial founder and that they're looking to really build a product that really stands up? What is up to any markets? What is your advice?
Build a 10x better product, build a 10x better distribution channel, and have great unit economics. That's pretty much it. Although that's almost impossible.
It's not impossible. It's just hard. Very, extremely hard.
And have really strong capital partners that are totally aligned with you on what it's going to take.
Sarah, we'll end it with you. What do you think?
I think, you know, having now done this for almost 8 years, like you can take advantage of some of the trends in the market and you can raise when the money is out there. You just can't spend that money that you raise. You have to be really honest that, okay, this was a really good time. We're going to put that money in the bank and we're going to continue operating just as frugally or almost as frugally as we have, because we don't know when the next, you know, payday is coming. So I think it's fine. You know, hopefully we do have another strong time in the future when there's money out there and you can raise and things are a little easier, but we can't change how we're, you know, how lean we're operating just because other companies may be doing crazy things.
Right.
You nailed it, Sarah. Like, I think the analogy was always like Amazon, you had to write a memo for like pens or something like that. And yeah. Google, you got three meals a day that were Michelin star. So there's different strokes for different folks and you have to understand where you are.
Yeah. And you need to understand how much what your gross margin is, your growth rate, and like who you're selling to as well. Like a lot of these B2B companies, let's pick a lever again. Who are you selling to? Like that can just kind of like cave in, potentially. And you need to have a backup plan. I'm sure they're doing fine, to be clear. I definitely will be a user of their product again one day. So let's not pick on them, but I think that's a good kind of note to end it on.
Right.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We're going to have more guests, I think, join next time that we're now past summer and everybody's gotten, well, actually, founders don't go to Italy. Well, maybe some do. Europe, but we'll have more people on. Coming on, please tell us what topics you want us to cover and we'll do our best to do it. Thanks everybody for listening.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, is everybody uploaded?
Are we done?
Mine is 99%.
By the way, my friend's on the board of fucking Lever.
Oh, nice.
Hey, we didn't back talk them at all. What is he doing?
I mean,